KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum next, veteran and award-winning journalist Lynn Joyner joins us for a conversation about her new book, Honorable Survivor. It's the story of diplomat John Servais, whom Lynn Joyner calls a modern Greek tragic hero. He was prescient about American interests in the necessity of opening up relation with Mao's China long before President Nixon traveled there, and as a result, he endured McCarthy anti-communist persecution, though many sides of this dramatic story have yet to be told. We'll hear all about it in the hour ahead when Lynn Joyner joins us in studio and tells her side of it after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Lynn Joyner is a veteran and award-winning broadcast journalist, a former news anchor, and a documentary filmmaker. She lives in San Francisco and is presently a media consultant for Shanghai Television. She's also worked for every major network as well as NPR. Used to host a program that some of you may recall called Foreign Exchange, and she's published in Time and the Los Angeles Times Magazine, as well as locally in the Chronicle and the Mercury News, and has written for Pacific News Service, and recently published a book called Honorable Survivor, Mao's China, McCarthy's America, and the Persecution of John S. Servais. It's the tragic story of an American diplomat whose life and experiences in wartime China and during the McCarthy era in the United States add up to one hell of a story. And Lynn Joyner joins us in studio for the second hour forum. Glad to see you. Welcome.
Michael, it's great to be here.
I guess, you know, the most pithy kind of Zen Cohen way is, has somebody described, 1940s, a traitor, 1990s, a patriot and a seer. But let's go and tell the story here. This was someone who really advocated a change in U.S. policy early on and recognized that there were going to probably be two Chinas. I mean, was that prescient?
Well, he alerted America to the fact there was another China that we didn't know about because we were dealing only with Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists. And what most Americans don't know then and didn't and still don't know today is that in the war, China was like a patchwork quilt of territories controlled by different warlords, by the occupying Japanese army, by the nationalists, and by there was a group underground called the Communists. And they had been forced to retreat because the nationalists and the Chinese communists at one time were allies. And there was this schism between them in a very bloody civil war. And the nationalists tried to eradicate them and almost did. And then the Chinese call it the Glorious Long March. Well, it was an escape for their lives. And they ended up in the boondocks of central China. And they ended up being able to depend upon the peasantry and create this new peasant revolution, which was not at all or not very much like the communism of the Soviet Union, but no one in America knew about it.
But it was certainly something that Servais recognized and Servais wanted to make those in power aware of. And it really was the centerpiece in his getting blamed for losing China to a great degree. I mean, the fact that he was able to recognize this, but also because of the Kuomintang, that is because of the Chiang Kai-shek nationalists who spread an extraordinary amount of disinformation about him.
Correct. And disinformation about the situation in China as well. But he became like the lightning rod for a convergence of various forces. First of all, he was on the personal hit list of Chiang Kai-shek because he had to deliver and translate a very blunt message from FDR that was declassified a while ago, in which FDR says to Chiang Kai-shek, listen, the war is going so badly. I really think you ought to appoint General Stilwell to be the commander of all Allied forces in China, which meant also the communist Chinese. And as Jack Servais told me, it was another bullet, another nail in my coffin. So it was the Chinese communists. It was Republicans who wanted to regain the White House and started attacking the Democrats for being soft on communism. It was a behind-the-scenes power struggle and a pissing contest, if you will, between the Justice Department and the FBI. And it was at the beginning of the Cold War where the Soviet Union, which had been our wartime ally and FDR called Stalin Uncle Joe, they had now brought down the Iron Curtain in Europe and everybody was afraid there was a wave of monolithic communism sweeping the world. And this was a convenient whipping boy, John Servais. And all he did is try and report what he saw on the ground. in China. And he wasn't alone. There were several other old China hands who were pilloried.
But he's also saying, in effect, don't take sides in the Civil War. He was cautioning against that.
Exactly. He first predicted that there might be a renewal of the Civil War, and it would hurt our efforts to fight against the Japanese. He was always concerned about American national interest. So in 1943, he brought this up on the radar screen a little bit, and he urged that we send American observers behind enemy lines to see what the communists were really doing. And it took 18 months to get Chiang Kai-shek to agree to allow Americans to go in there. And it's when he was there that he had these remarkable conversations with Mao and other leaders, which some people think was a lost chance in China to have a different kind of relationship with the emerging revolutionary China, and others see as just opportunism on the part of the Chinese communists. But I got to add one other thing, Michael. It's also, he had a brief love affair with an actress in Chongqing during the war when his family had been evacuated. And he wrote to his wife and asked for a divorce, and she refused to give it to him. Well, 5 years later, the nationalist Chinese spread disinformation that he had fathered an illegitimate child by his Soviet spy lover during the war. And that, I found in my efforts to get declassified documents under Freedom of Information Act. That was one of the real reasons why he was fired, because they could not prove he was disloyal. They said that there was doubt about his loyalty, but they had nothing to prove it because wasn't.
The lover just exacerbated the whole notion that he was somehow working against American interests and tied in a collusive way or conspiratorial way. I mean, it's pretty clear now from the records, and I want to find out more about how you got those records, because that in itself is quite a story, and had access to as much as you did get access to. But when you look at the story, you know, just the timing was so much against him. Here he is associating with Mao Zedong, all this fear, as you say, of monolithic communism, the Red Chinese. I mean, I remember it myself. And the sense that McCarthy in 1950, coming out with a speech of his in Wheeling, talking about, 205 card-carrying communists. I mean, suddenly service was tainted by all that. He became really one of the victims of McCarthyism.
Oh, he was the first victim, because McCarthy, in his speech at Wheeling, West Virginia in 1950, only mentioned four people by name. And the first one he mentioned was John Service. And, I have in my book the excerpt from that speech in which he basically says, during the war, this guy was trying to overthrow Chiang Kai-shek and say that communism was the only hope for China. And then he was mysteriously arrested and never brought to trial. And now he's on his way to a post in India, our most important listening post in all of Asia. And John Service and his wife and their three kids were on a freighter on their way to India during this campaign of McCarthy across the country and when he went back to the Senate. And one night at dinner, this crewman came down to the captain's table and said, "Excuse me, but is your name John Stewart Service?" And Jack said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you better come up to the radio room. There's some senator talking about you." And that's how they found out that he was under attack.
Talking to Lynn Joyner, her new book is Honorable Survivor, Mao's China, McCarthy's America, and the Persecution of John S. Service. Actually, the prime reason for the dismissal from the Foreign Service was, I guess, the love affair, wasn't it, as you've been able to determine?
It wasn't publicly said that was it, but I have discovered that the secret transcripts from these meetings of this loyalty review board. And by the way, Michael, that's kind of interesting. He underwent twin loyalty investigations, one inside the State Department and one by the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee subcommittee. And he was proven loyal in both of those. But it had to be reviewed by the president's loyalty review board that he set up as protection for anyone who had been accused of being disloyal. This would be the court of last resort. They could go and present the case again. In John Service's case, they actually reversed the positive and made it negative. And when you see the transcripts from their meetings, you understand that it was partly because of the lover, and then it was partly because of some wiretapped hotel conversations he had with the editor of this Asian journal called AmerAsia.
Yeah, I want to talk with you about that. But first off, there's a big mystery about why an indictment was pulled, isn't there? Somebody named Corcoran who was involved in this?
Well, there was no indictment. That was the whole point. Yes, it's a very interesting web of suspicions and strains. As I mentioned, he was kind of the point of the convergence point for a lot of different forces. Tommy the Cork Corcoran is America's first modern lobbyist. He was one of the original New Dealers, and he helped write a lot of the social legislation of Roosevelt's New Deal. And in 1940, he became a lawyer who peddled influence. Well, John Service had been incurred one of his jobs. He was assigned by from the State Department, he was recruited by the War Department to be a political advisor to General Stilwell in China. And one of his jobs was to be the liaison to the Chinese communists, who were allowed to have a legal office in Chongqing, because in theory, it was still a national unity of the Chinese and the communists fighting against the common foe, the Japanese, with the U.S. So one of his jobs was to be the liaison to the Chinese communists. The other thing was to give background briefings to American journalists, war correspondents, and fill them in on this very complicated political warfare between all the different rival groups in China, plus the British, plus the Japanese. And he was well suited for it. He spoke several dialects of Chinese. He'd been born and raised.
His parents were missionaries, right?
They were YMCA people, and they started the YMCA in Chengdu in 1906. And so he knew that he knew China better than he knew inside the Beltway, Washington. And so this guy, Tommy the Cork, comes into his life because of his superiors at the State Department and some back channel people at the White House. And it was a crazy way to run foreign policy. It was run out of the White House by Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins, with very little to do with the whole State Department.
But it still remains mysterious as to why this indictment didn't go forward, or why there was no indictment, doesn't it?
Well, you got to kind of read the book. It's kind of complicated for our listeners to follow all this. But essentially what happened is Tommy the Cork was asked to help find a lawyer for John Service. And he had other interests involved. He actually represented the nationalist Chinese and helped get them supplies from America under Lend-Lease. He was a good friend of the guy at the White House, a good friend of the guy at the State Department. They didn't want it known that they had also been pushing. There was a whole group within the government that wanted to change our policy in China, who agreed with John Service and some of the men on the ground about the reality of the situation, and that we ought to be pragmatic and deal with both Chinas, because our common enemy was Japan, and also because John Service had the foresight to look beyond, and he did not want to throw the Chinese communists into the arms of the Soviets, and he didn't want the Soviets to gain power and influence in northern China. What happened is there were wiretap conversations between Tommy the Cork and high officials at the Justice Department. Why was there a wiretap on Tommy the Cork? Because the Truman White House was nervous and insecure about the former New Dealers, and they had ordered it. And so this added to the suspicion.
It is
Well, you know, I've always said that fact is stranger than fiction. And if anybody goes to Amazon.com and looks at some of the reviews that have been written about the book and given it 5 stars, I'm happy to say, one of them says that you know, it would make a great movie, and he starts to talk about who to cast. And even the former Assistant Secretary of State under Clinton, who wrote one of the endorsements that's on the back cover, who sees resonances in John Service's story with what's happening in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Iraq, and Iran. Her last line, and I love it, she said, "I can't wait to see the movie."
Yeah, it's almost tailor-made for a movie. There's some real controversy here, though. I mean, he's friend of yours. You met him many years ago. You struck up a friendship. Obviously, you're an advocate of his side of the story to some degree. I mean, you're a thorough journalist, but let me just frame this right, if I can. Because Harvey Clare wrote a review, as I understand it, in the National Review, and gave you high plaudits, and it was a very laudatory review. But Harvey Clare and Donald Radish also wrote a book a number of years ago where they said that the wiretapping of John Service by the FBI, and I know you've got the actual communique from J. Edgar Hoover, which I'd like our listeners to hear, but that actual wiretapping had him say, "Keep this a secret and don't say anything about supposedly military kinds of things." And they were suggesting that all of those people in Amer Asia, that magazine, were largely like a nest of real communists.
I just feel that as a journalist, I have to say that what I try to do is let the listeners decide for themselves. I was able to pull out a lot of new facts that people didn't have, even Harvey Clare. And he didn't give me a laudatory review. He gave me a respectful one. And he said I had a felicitous writing style and had brought out some new information.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. But what happened is there was an illegal wiretap in this hotel room where John Service met with the editor of this journal called Amer Asia. And as they were coming in the door one morning—
Who was a communist, by the way?
No, he supported communism. He supported communist front organizations. He was a wealthy man who had a greeting card company, as a matter of fact. And he had been— this Amer Asia, he had had contributions from very respected academics and people at the State Department through its first few years. And then it went into the whole ideological backflip when the Soviet Union had the treaty with Nazi Germany, and they left, and his subscription went down, and he ended up writing the whole thing himself with his deputy editor, and they plagiarized a secret report that they got. They got leaks from inside the government, Michael. That's what it was. But they were arrested on charges of conspiracy to commit espionage. They never proved any espionage. And Jack Service walked into this nest and this web of suspicion from China, not knowing that the FBI had already fingered some of the people in the State Department and the Naval Intelligence who were feeding this information to the
magazine. Was there not a contention that secret documents were given by John Service to Amer Asia?
As it turns out, there were documents that reports that John Service had written from China that had the fingerprints of one of the other people from the State Department who was the leaker. What John Service did, and he always admitted it, even the first night he was arrested, he told the FBI he had loaned about 10 of his reports fresh from his talks with Mao Zedong and the Chinese communists. He'd just been called home to report on his talks. He loaned them to this editor. He had shown things to journalists in the past on a background basis, but never allowed them to take them. And he said, I really messed up.
But then there's that direct quote of his: what I said about military plans is, of course, secret. And that was taped.
That was taped. And the problem was, during the investigations, the State Department and the Senate committee asked the Justice Department to turn over the tapes because that comment was leaked to the press. And then there was no context for it. And so they both asked for the transcriptions. And the lawyers at the Justice Department ruled that since it had been illegally obtained, it could not be given out, even though FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had given it to McCarthy, who leaked it to the press. And when Hoover got the report from one of his agents saying that they had ruled against it, he said, I don't agree. I want everything on John Service out there. This is an administrative hearing. This is not, the rules of justice do not apply. And that was in a handwritten note at the bottom of this document that I got declassified from the FBI.
I also want to mention this was an illegal wiretap, of course, and he was fired in disgrace, and there was 25 years that went by before anything really resulted.
Well, he won in the Supreme Court. So he lost his job. He lost his pension. He got a job with a company that made industrial steam traps. But he kept the fight going. He had a great lawyer who felt that they had a chance. And in 1957, they won on a unanimous vote of the United States Supreme Court, and he got reinstated. What happened, though, is the price they paid. He got his job back, but his career was neutralized.
Well, they were giving him diddly like nothing, and then his reputation wasn't restored until Nixon went, right?
Well, he was vindicated to a certain extent in 1957, but only when Nixon was interested in having a better relationship with the People's Republic of China, which for 27 years we had not recognized and we had had an economic embargo against. Service was invited back by the communists as a signal they wanted better relations with the U.S., and he met secretly with Kissinger in Beijing in October of 71 when Kissinger was working out all the details for Nixon. And I talked to one of Kissinger's assistants who said, Kissinger was surprised to hear when Jack mentioned that he had talked with Mao, and he said, my goodness, would you be willing to come to San Clemente when you get home from China? And Service said, well, yes. And so when Kissinger walked him to the door, he said, now, I want you to call my secretary as soon as you get home. Well, the assistant said the call never was made because he went back to Washington and found out what a controversial figure John Service was. And he said, you know, because it was such a delicate negotiation, we wanted to steer clear of upsetting the old vestiges of the China lobby, and therefore we refused to talk to the only American who had had substantive talks with Mao Zedong.
Talking about Lynn Joyner, her book is Honorable Survivor, and we should mention that Lynn first met John Service, who she calls Jack Service, at Cornell, heard about him at Cornell, but met him actually at Stanford, and then went on to access...
I met him at a conference about the hot topic, should we recognize Red China?
There you go. But you got access to all this oral history at Berkeley and then Freedom of Information Act. This has been, what, 10 years of research?
Oh, at least. John and Caroline Service allowed me to read their oral histories at UC Berkeley, where, by the way, because he couldn't get his career back on track, he took early retirement and at age 52 enrolled at UC Berkeley to get a master's in political science at age 52. And he, his professors were flabbergasted when they found out he was the John Service when they were teaching about Stillwell in China. But he was invited to join the Center for Chinese Studies at Berkeley and helped make it into the world-renowned center for research on China that it became.
And passed away in 1999 here in Oakland, that is in the Bay Area. Coming up on a break, though, you've mentioned a few times how this story really resonates for you in terms of our involvement now. And I mean, on the one hand, we might have been able to avoid a lot of the enmity, obviously, with communist China. We might have even been able to avoid Korea and Vietnam had we listened to Service. I think that's part of your thesis. But the parallels to what's going on in Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan?
There are some.
Yeah,
do we have time for it before the break?
We've got a couple minutes, so
okay,
as best you can
good.
Outline. Yeah.
Essentially, the thing about it is I mentioned about how the country of China was divided into a patchwork quilt with different warlords and different factions. Well, if you look at Pakistan and you look at Afghanistan today, it's a similar situation. Service was reporting on the corruption and bribery of the nationalist government and how the people had lost faith in that government and how the government's base was becoming narrower and narrower. And he was relying on, and Chiang Kai-shek was relying on, a very small group of landlords and different interests. And I think we see parallels.
You see Karzai and Chiang Kai-shek.
Funny
almost.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Funny thing about that, yeah. And the other thing is today, our embassies have turned into fortresses, and our consulates are little forts, and everybody runs around in their Humvees, armored Humvees, because they're so afraid of IEDs. And in John Service's time, he could get on a public bus and travel by himself, and he wasn't wrapped in the saran wrap, that I call it, of being a foreigner in a country where you don't speak the language. He didn't have minders. He didn't have interpreters who were hired, who might be being paid by the other side as much as by our side. So I think there are some resonances. I think the other thing is, after John Service and the other China hands were fired, there was a chilling effect on the diplomats and the Foreign Service.
Let me give out the phone number. Invite those of you listening to join us with Lynn Joyner. If you have questions or comments, you can do that now, toll free. I see Gregory Peck, by the way, in this role, but unfortunately we don't have him around anymore. You can join us now at 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, any questions or comments, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Feel free to be a part of today's program, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. The book is Honorable Survivor, Mao's China, McCarthy's America, and the Persecution of John S. Service. Lynn Joyner with us, and you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and if you've just joined us, we're talking to veteran broadcaster Lynn Joyner, who has a book out called Honorable Survivor. It's the story of John S. Service, Mao's China, McCarthy's America, and what she calls the persecution of John S. Service. And our own local Adam Hochschild, the author of King Leopold's Ghost, says, sometimes a writer can use one person's story to illuminate an entire piece of history, and that is what Lynn Joyner does in her engrossing and readable book. This is both a solid addition to scholarship of the Cold War era and a moving, very personal story of the life of one man, brilliant, flawed, long-suffering, and honorable indeed. And if you would like to join us in this conversation, it's toll-free from wherever you're listening or however, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. And now you can leave questions and comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum. And speaking of websites, there are photos, some really remarkable photos, as well as excerpts from Lynn's book on her website, which is simply honorablesurvivor.com. And talking about some of what Mao Zedong actually told service, before we go to calls and emails, I wanted to get that on the record here.
Good. I appreciate that. I want to back up, though, because you asked me the resonances to today. And I wanted to say that after he was vindicated and there was the historic handshake between Mao and Nixon, he was invited along with the old China hands to a special luncheon at the State Department. And he gave some remarks. And he said at that time, if I may quote him, "Foreign service reporting becomes vital as we move toward countries that may be small, less developed, non-white, or with cultures and institutions drastically different from our own. If we keep ourselves in ignorance and out of touch with new popular movements and potentially revolutionary situations, we may find ourselves again missing the boat." So now that's the question. Did we or didn't we? Time marches on, history marches on. But I remember in 1978, when it was announced that we would formalize diplomatic relations between China and the U.S., I was with John and Caroline Service, and he bought a bottle of champagne, and we toasted the friendship of the Chinese and American people. And that was when he started to tell me about these remarkable conversations he had with Mao during the 3 months in 1944, the fall of 44, when he was in Yan'an, which was behind enemy lines where the communist stronghold was. And Mao said that he would follow General Stilwell, that he would put his guerrillas under Stilwell, and they would cooperate behind enemy lines. The OSS, which is the precursor of the CIA, they had elaborate plans for outfitting 20,000 communist guerrillas and giving them 100,000 assassin pistols, as well as training in demolitions. They actually demonstrated how to use plastique and so forth with the communists. There's some pictures in the book and on the website that show this big meeting where they're talking about this stuff. And Jack, when he first arrived, they had a big welcoming dinner. There were first nine Americans who went. John Service, who all his friends called Jack, was the only diplomat. Everyone else was military or secret agents embedded with the military from the OSS. And Mao said to him, "I know that you and I have to talk. We have a lot to talk about. But I want you to look around and get to know us. And any questions you have, we will make sure that you get to talk to the right people." And they were having a big meeting of the Communist Party. And so all the guerrilla leaders were coming in from all over the occupied territory for these meetings. And they gave up-to-date briefings. They let the Americans interview POWs, which the Nationalists didn't have that many POWs, so they didn't offer them. But he talked to him about their desire to cooperate with the U.S. He said, "We cannot afford to cross the United States of America. That's why it's so important we know what your intentions are and what you need from us." And he also talked to Service.
All of which made him seem perhaps to the powers that be more of a lackey to the communist Chinese, correct?
Well, nobody knew about these talks.
I mean, once it became apparent when there were pictures of him with Mao and later
there
on.
There weren't.
And so
later on,
there were photographs, I thought, of him with Mao Zedong.
There were photographs that were taken. I thought you meant during the war.
No,
time.
No, not during the war. I'm
no,
talking
during
about
the
later
McCarthy
on. All this
era.
Was,
oh, yeah, during the McCarthy yeah. era, sure, he was considered a lackey and a dupe and all that stuff. But this is just what he wrote down, what he recorded as what Mao told him in Chinese in Yan'an.
Was this part of what was thrown overboard by his wife?
I'm getting to that. Sorry. Yeah. And the other thing he said is he wanted to try to avoid civil war, that if the U.S. could help arrange some kind of a coalition government. Now, this had been done in other places, but a coalition government, and they were given some power sharing, he would be willing to go that way. And he didn't, they would not be the first to start war against the Nationalists. And they were fearful, and a lot of Americans were fearful, that Chiang Kai-shek was avoiding resisting General Stilwell's plans for a counteroffensive because he wanted to stockpile American arms and supplies to use against his real enemy, the communists. But anyway, he said, we want to avoid it if we can, and we want American help in rebuilding our war-torn country. Because this country had been at war for 30 years, ever since the overthrow of the last dynasty, and had been weak before that. And Service said to him, well, you know, a lot of American businessmen might not feel comfortable about trying to make deals with communists. And Mao told Jack Service that they had at one point considered changing the name of the party. But they decided, well, once people get to know us, they won't feel so bad about it. And I sort of looked at what's happening in China today. I was just there this summer doing some consulting. And all the major companies, corporations, entrepreneurs all from all over the Western world are doing business with the communist Chinese this day. And it started out where it had to be a joint venture. Now you can have wholly owned foreign ventures in China. But this was part of the plan that Mao Zedong outlined to John Service back in 1944.
Going to get to our callers quickly, though. Stuff thrown overboard.
When John Service was on that ship on his way to his assignment in India, he got a cable saying, come back to Washington. We've got to talk to you and clear this all up. And he was optimistic, as always. He was always optimistic that he could clear it up and probably fly to India and get there before the freighter arrived, because it was going to take his family another month to get there. And instead, he got trapped in 18 months of persecution and investigations in Washington, and his family got caught in limbo in India for over a year. And on that trip, Michael, his wife, who was so nervous and upset about the hysteria that was sweeping America, that she took his Yan'an notebooks and threw them overboard. And when I interviewed John Service many, many years later, I said, well, how did you feel when you found out she did that? He said, well, I didn't find out about it for over a year when they finally were able to return from India. And he said, and then what good would it have done? He was always very pragmatic.
Listener in Oakland writes, you had mentioned that his parents were YMCA affiliated. Well, missionaries, in effect. Will you please ask Lynn Joyner to provide some basic background about the subject of her book? Can she please tell your listeners something about his early life, where he was educated, something about the career path that led him to the point at which the book seems to begin? I feel somewhat as though I've come into the middle of the movie.
Well, I'm afraid that the book starts at the very beginning, but we just didn't start our conversation on the radio in the middle of at the beginning. But yes, there's...
Medias res is sometimes a good way to begin, by the way.
Yes. I guess you might just have to go buy the book. But actually, no, it talks a lot about his childhood and growing up in Chengdu and being carried around by sedan chairs, which he hated. And by the time he was 10, when the family would go out of Chengdu to get on home leave, they would have to go by boat. And it was very treacherous to come up through the Yangtze Gorges. And they would get off in Chongqing. And then it was a 250-mile overland trip to get into Chengdu. And they would have these caravans. And they'd be with escorts because there were all these bandits and warlord armies and so forth. And by the time he was 10, John Service could walk 25 miles a day on this instead of being carried on the shoulders of Chinese laborers. He didn't like that at all. But there's a lot about his early life. He was homeschooled until he was 11. Then he went to Shanghai American School, and he went to Oberlin. But he traveled from China all the way to Oberlin for 6 months through Europe. He bicycled. He was quite an adventurer and a risk taker, I might say.
And got into Foreign Service how?
Well, because one of his childhood friends, John Patton Davies, had gotten in, and it was at the time of the Depression. He originally thought he wanted to be an art historian professor, but he couldn't get a scholarship to continue his studies, and he found out that John Davies had taken the exam and passed. So he took the exam, he passed, and he started as a lowly clerk in Yunnanfu, which is now known as Kunming, out in Yunnan province.
Let's bring our callers in. Mark from Woodside, join us. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for taking the call. I interviewed Jack Service in 1970 when I was preparing my honors thesis in college. I also interviewed John Davies and David Barrett and others involved in Yan'an and during the war. And I wonder whether your book gets into the role played by then Ambassador Patrick J. Hurley, whose vendetta against so many of the State Department people who worked with him initiated much of the McCarthy purge.
Oh, I'm sitting here with a big smile on my face. Thank you for mentioning Patrick Hurley. He really was the cause of much of the misinformation and confusion about what was really going on in China. And he had it in for John Service. At one point when John Service came back from Washington, where he had been for consultations, he said to him, "Don't you get in my way or I'll break you." And indeed, he brought up many of the charges against John Service. When he resigned in frustration and failure in November of 1945, after his failed efforts at negotiations between the Chinese communists and the nationalists, he blamed the old China hands. But Michael, you'll be interested in this. This was a lawyer negotiator from Oklahoma who likened the nationalists and the communists to the Democrats and the Republican Party of Oklahoma. And the only difference between the Republicans and the communists was that the communists had guns. And also, FDR, instead of listening to the reports coming in from the field, he listened to Hurley. And he told his son, Jimmy Roosevelt, "You know, I wish I had more men like Patrick Hurley, because, you know, if there's anyone who can solve the internal political problems of the Chinese, it's Pat Hurley."
Let me thank Mark for the call. And listener in Berkeley, Herb, writes, "My good friend and neighbor for about 15 years, Jack Service. Should be said that it wasn't just about Jack, but also about Caroline, his wife, who endured much of the brunt of the forces against Jack, not only in China, but also in the USA. Both were the kindest people, admirable in their integrity and lack of bitterness about all that had happened to them." The book China Hands covers much of Jack Service's plight. Jack himself pointed me to that book. And Max in Berkeley says, "I have a question for your guest. It's about Simon Lees, an insightful observer of China during the Cultural Revolution, who produced critical essays on that revolution, for which he was vilified and hounded by self-styled Maoists in the West. Would your guest be willing to talk briefly about him? Perhaps the question is unfair, but I thought I would ask anyway."
No, I respect what Simon Lees did, and he helped look under the rocks that no Americans could see because we had this bamboo curtain between us for so many years. And John Service, I sat with John and Carolyn, and I want to get on to your other message about the role that Carolyn played, because I agree with that listener. But John Service, in 1989, I was invited to their home for lunch on June 4th, which was the day that the tanks started rolling through Tiananmen Square. And Service expressed great sadness over what was going on and the continual tragedy of China for the people and the disillusionment he felt with the direction that that promising peasant revolution that he had witnessed the birth of in the 40s had taken, and partly out of some of the actions and non-action of the United States. Now, what he said is that he had hoped that we could at least have given Mao a chance to put his money where his mouth is. He kept claiming he wanted a good relationship with the U.S., and we turned our back on that. And he said if we'd given him the opportunity, perhaps the end of the war would have been different. We would have had Americans embedded with the communist guerrillas when they took over surrender of the Japanese, instead of having Chiang Kai-shek order the Japanese not to surrender to the communists. And later on, when Jack went to China on that trip in 1971, he came back and he wrote a series of reports for the New York Times. And he told me later that he thought he had been a little gullible and he was accused of not knowing and not reporting on the horrors of the Cultural Revolution, which were still underway. And he said, "You know, my measuring stick is a lot different than many people. I'm looking at the changes from the early 1900s to 1970s, when there were, you know, babies left to die, when there were just terrible floods and famines and so forth that were caused by nature, not by man. But he came to respect the kind of insights that we got about the Cultural Revolution, but we weren't there, so we couldn't report on it. Simon Lez was French, as I recall.
Yes.
One other thing about Caroline, if I may.
Yes.
Quickly. She was really the rock, and she spent a year in India with three small children. She endured the horrors of knowing that her husband had been unfaithful and had said that he'd fallen in love with this woman. And at the end of their lives, all three of them, the Chinese actress and Caroline and John Service, all lived within 100 miles of each other in California. There's a couple of pictures of them in the book.
And we go to Palo Alto. Mary, join us on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I lived in the house directly across from Jack and Carolyn on Santa Barbara Road. And I have in front of me right now, Married to the Foreign Service and Lost Chance in China, which Jack wrote and wrote a little dedication to me and my husband. And I am looking especially at Carolyn's a paragraph that Carolyn wrote in Married to the Foreign Service, and it really speaks to what Lynn just said. And I'm going to read it to you. And she says, I'd gotten a very leery of phone calls and radios. You better listen to the radio, Miss Friend said. Hurley has resigned, and he is saying that Jack and George Acheson and John Davies have lost China, and he's resigning because they were subversive and because they undermined him. And I have such wonderful memories, just like Herb, of living with the services, essentially. And they were indeed a wonderful couple. I was honored to speak at Carolyn's memorial service. And I have such fond memories of my life there and them. And I think, actually, that I met you at their house once or twice when they would have one of their little social events. And again, if he's listening, I want to say thank you to Sheldon, who called me and told me that you were on the radio. And I'm placing an order for the book as we speak.
Oh, well, bless you for that. I sure appreciate that. And I hope you'll check out some of the photos and the excerpts on www.honorablesurvivor.com. I'd like to say that that book that you mentioned, Lost Chance in China, that is a collection of his World War II dispatches. So if anybody wants to see what Jack really wrote, you can get it. It was published in the 1970s, but it still you can find some copies if you mouse around on your website. And the other book I'd like to mention to people who are interested in his early years is called Golden Inches, and it was a memoir of his mother and her pioneer life in the boondocks of China at the turn of the century. It was published by UC Press. It's out of print, but again, you can find it on web. And both of those collections were very important for me in my research.
And let me thank Mary for her call. More calls in just a moment, but more emails first. There are a lot of these personal connections. Here's a listener says, I went to college with Service's son back in the 50s. It's my recollection that he was planning a career in the Foreign Service. I recall thinking that that choice was remarkable given the experience of his father at the time. Is my recollection correct, and did Service's son join the diplomatic service?
Robert Service did join the diplomatic service. He became a specialist in Latin affairs, and he was confirmed as ambassador in 1994. And it was only at that point that I called him and said, congratulations, Bob, you made it to the top rung. Maybe now you can help me convince your mother to let me do this book. Caroline Service did not want me to do this book. I wanted to do it back in 1980.
Why was she opposed?
Because she was afraid it would reflect badly and damage her son's opportunities in his Foreign Service career. So I wanted to do the book in 1980. I'm glad I didn't, because so much more material came out since then, including the Venona files. And we haven't talked about that, Michael. But this is one reason
why
Harvey Clare and Richard Radosh and those people of that bent on the anti-communist historical revisionism believe what they believe. The Venona files is
we've done shows on it, by the way. They're in our archives.
Okay, fine. Well, I'll just mention it briefly to our listeners. It was a series of decoded Soviet cables between Moscow, Washington, New York, which We were afraid that Soviets might sue for a separate peace with the Nazis, and that's why we started decrypting their cables. But what we discovered, and it wasn't cracked, the code wasn't cracked till after the war, that there was an ambitious, aggressive effort on the part of the Soviet Union to get information about America and to influence policymakers and to recruit spies. And it was through the Venona files that we found out about the atomic spies, for example. The Rosenbergs and Harry Gold and all of the others. And in 1950, they then, everything kind of merged. And this man who had broken into the AmerAsia offices and found all these government documents, including the ones of John Service with the fingerprints of this other guy, he then in 1950, 5 years later, said he thinks he remembers seeing some report about the atomic bomb. Well, nobody knew about the atomic bomb at that time. It was secret. But John Service's name morphed and became associated also with the atomic spies and with the Soviet Union and so forth.
Ah, the Cold War, huh?
Ah, the Cold War.
Here's Peter from San Carlos who makes a good point. Now the State Department rotates Foreign Service officers after 3 to 4 years in a post. Therefore, they rarely learn local culture and politics. Is this the legacy of John Service and the other China hands? If so, it's a shame of our government.
Oh, tragic, tragic. John Service, when he was a clerk in Yunnanfu, waiting to get, there was a freeze on, he'd passed the test to become a Foreign Service officer, but because of the Depression, there was a hiring freeze. I guess we know about that these days. But anyway, he finally got appointed, and he went to Beijing, and he spent 3 years studying Chinese, because even though he spoke Sichuan dialect, he had Mandarin tutors who abhorred his accent and his dialect, and he learned to read and write proper Chinese. They do have language training these days, but it isn't like that. And the rotation of 3-4 years, on the one hand, it's a sad thing. On the other hand, John Service feels that it would have probably given him more perspective had he been rotated at a certain point out of China and gone to Moscow. But they needed him back in China. And when he went back, that's when Ambassador Hurley really went after him and got him recalled and then accused him of treason because he had been handed false information by the nationalist Chinese who were trying to say the only reason he was failing in his mission was because these army officers and the OSS and diplomats like John Service were undermining him. He was very paranoid.
Another decidedly different point of view comes from Dan in San Rafael, who says Chiang Kai-shek was corrupt and incompetent, but Mao Zedong was a mass murderer, and Service was a simpleton to believe him. Mao told Service what he wanted to hear. Mao was evil, not a misunderstood Abe Lincoln who incompetent American diplomacy turned into a monster.
Well, excuse me, but I would disagree respectfully with that whole kind of thing.
I'm sure you've heard this.
Chiang Kai-shek was—
this kind of thing before.
I have heard this before, and I am not excusing Mao, nor did John Service. All we are saying and all he said when I report on it is that Mao claimed that this is what he would do if the United States were forthcoming and wanted a relationship with the guerrillas during the war. And what would happen after that, I don't know. But maybe there would have been a moderation of his policies. But to claim that Chiang Kai-shek did not have blood on his hands is a falsehood as well. And these are not people who don't have blood on their hands from very, very early in the era. I mean, there's a new book out on Generalissimo. There's a new book out on Madame Zhang. There's my book on John Service. Read all three and come to your own conclusions. But no, I'm not. I have too many Chinese friends who I've known over 30 years in my trips back and forth to China and my documentary work there, who have told me their own tragic stories. And so I do not ever excuse the excesses. But as Mao said long ago, a revolution is not a dinner party.
There's a listener who says, I wonder if Paul Childs, Julia Childs' husband, and John Service were working at the same time. Paul Childs was also investigated and his loyalty was called in question. Do you know?
Yes, I do. And I was amused when I saw the movie and saw that they have that scene in there. But Paul, as Julia says in the movie, he suffered a lot less than many of our friends. Paul was only investigated and interrogated for 3 days and then he was let go. John Service underwent 18 months of hell.
Actually, speaking about movies, naturally, since we mentioned who's going to be cast as John Service, we're getting a number of suggestions. Michael says, heard the comment about who should portray Service in the film adaptation. I agree with you, Michael, Gregory Peck, but I would vote for Adrian Brody. And another listener, Brian, says, could you see George Clooney playing John Service?
I would love George Clooney, but he's a little old for the role. But I hope there's some producers and directors out there listening. My father was a writer, director, producer in Hollywood, and he loved the scenes in my book between the beautiful Chinese actress and John Service. And he said, you know, there's not enough dialogue in there. What did they say when their letters? I said, Dad, it was wartime. They didn't have many letters. They didn't have letters, really. And he said, well, you know, they're both dead. Why don't you just make it up? And I said, look, when we get to the screenplay stage.
Your father was a Hollywood guy.
He was a Hollywood guy. I said, this is a serious nonfiction biography.
And
I
have an actress from Crouching Tiger. I mean,
yeah, but crazy. I have an annotated footnotes that go on for over 60 pages, because everything that I bring out in the book that I got through my research, especially waiting 4 years to get Freedom of Information Act access to FBI and State Department files, is backed up.
We've got seconds left here. David, quickly, if you could.
Just a quick question. What relationship, if any, did John have with Orville Schell?
Orville Schell was a PhD student at the time John Service was at the Center for Chinese Studies at Berkeley, and John Service was known as the PhD doctor. He was a superb editor, and he was a friend to all who came to know him, and he loved helping graduate students, and I think if you asked Orville, he would tell you that. Orville actually gave a comment that's on the back of the...
I was just going to read it. Joyner ably, this is from Orville Schell, now director of the Center for U.S.-China Relations, Asia Society, says Joyner ably tells the tragic story of a good American laid low by the basest kind of character assassination masquerading as anti-communism. All one can say is read this book and weep. And I will echo that. It's a hell of a book. Honorable Survivor, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks. It'd make a holiday gift wonderful under the tree or with the Hanukkah candles.
Or Kwanzaa or whatever.
Don't
let anybody out here. We did a whole thing
please.
On inclusiveness in the last hour. And by the way, you can continue this discussion by simply going online at kqed.org/forum. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.